Welcome to the January 3rd, 2014 Jubilize Me podcast.
Jubilize me.
So, we are in the first podcast. Sorry, folks. I was doing a little bit of an Elmer thing and made everybody laugh. Okay, we're good. We're good. This is the first Jubilize Me podcast of 2014. Woo! Welcome to the new year. I hope everybody had a really good New Year holiday celebration thing. I certainly did. I had a freaking blast. I was so happy to be home here in Denmark for that. So I am Addison Berry, your hostess for today's podcast, and I have with me two first-time podcasters. Dun 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 dun. I have Todd Meinkirk, who is
hello everybody
digital strategist and partner at Four Kitchens Drupal Shop down there in the Texan area. And then another Texan. Look at this: two first-timers and two Texans. I didn't even know that.
What are the odds?
It's crazy. Brian Scowron, the sales director over here at Lullabot.
Hello.
So I have these two fine Texan gentlemen on the line with me today to talk about consultancy scrum. And we're going to explain what that means, because, like, what does that mean? But basically, it's talking about Agile and how you work with using Agile when you're dealing in a sort of client-vendor relationship instead of an internal team. So we're going to get way into that and let these guys talk your ears off for a while. But before we do, we got to do the news. You know, this is the real here, people. So first of all, make sure you check out our other podcasts. We have The Creative Process with Jared Ponchot, and we also have Insert Content Here with Jeff Eaton. So they have some episodes up on lullabot.com as well. And we also, just so you know, we started the PSD to theme videos, I think, right before Christmas. So we have that series still coming along. And so we're about, I think, halfway into the series with Emma teaching you how to do that. You got a PSD, how do you make it into an actual Drupal theme, which is what the people want. And then in terms of event news stuff, we're also going to be having actually a podcast about this coming up. But I want to put it on everybody's calendar that there's the Global Sprint Weekend is coming up January 25th and 26th. It is happening all over the world. So there's going to be Drupal sprints happening all over the place, online, all kinds of stuff that weekend. So you should go check it out. I'll put notes in the podcast, the link in the podcast notes thing. And then another event to put on your radar, especially if you are in the New Zealand, Australia area. Drupal South is going to be in Wellington, New Zealand, February 14th through 16th, St. Valentine's Day. Emma and John Alvin Wilkins are both speaking there, and they're doing a workshop on PSD to theme. So if you want to learn all about, like, and it's not just like, you know, PSD and stuff, but it also really gets into sort of like CSS management using SMACs and stuff like that, if you want to know what that stuff is. So anyway, if you're down in that area, check that event out, because it's kind of like the big shiz-bang happening on that side of the planet in February. Cool. See, I made it really fast that time. So, don't complain, people. I know, it's the boring part you got to get through until you get to the meat. And now I'm just like filling up space and I'm keeping everybody in suspense because I'm just not actually really getting to it. I'm just talking about getting to it. I love it. All right. Okay, fine. Let's talk about consultancy scrum. And I'm just going to put it out there to start off with. So first of all, scrum, kind of a funny word when you're talking about business. And then consultancy scrum is not a combination that I have heard before. So what exactly is scrum, and in particular, what would be the consultancy flavor of it? Like, what's the significance of that?
Sure. So, hey, everybody, this is Todd. So to summarize scrum super quickly in a way that might not actually be helpful to anybody who isn't entirely familiar with project management methodologies, it is a form of agile project management. So there are lots of different agile techniques that are used in project management, and Scrum is one flavor of those, and it's probably the most popular flavor. So what does all of that mean? The best way to describe Scrum is to say that it's a project management methodology that focuses on rapid iteration and rapidly produced workable code or workable product. So most projects are run on a sprint schedule, and a sprint is usually about a 2-week period of work where a certain amount of deliverables are agreed to, and at the end of those 2 weeks, it's demoed to the stakeholders, and they accept or reject the work, and that work, if it's accepted, is potentially shippable. And what that means is you could actually go live with that right away at the end of every 2 weeks. So the idea is that you're rapidly iterating through building something, in this case a website. It could also be a product or a piece of hardware or really anything, but focusing on rapid iterations and delivering value quickly, essentially, to organizations, to their users, their audience, whomever. It is a reaction to the more traditional form of project management that is often referred to as waterfall. And without getting into why it's called waterfall, waterfall is the kind of project management that everybody has been exposed to at some point, whether it's in their personal lives or working at an organization or whatever. It's when you do a whole bunch of planning up front, and you build all the blueprints, and you know detail by detail everything you're going to do, and then you start to build it. And usually all of that stuff is expressed as, you could think of it like a Gantt chart, where first you do feature A, and then you do feature B, and then you do feature C, and those things flow like a waterfall down the river. And at the end of that period, when you finally have everything done, then you can launch this product or website or piece of hardware or whatever it is you're trying to build. There are pros and cons to both approach. We have been using Scrum at 4Kitchen since about 2007, and it completely changed how we do everything, how we interact with our client partners, how we build projects, how we think about projects, how we actually structure our organization internally. So it's been a it's kind of at the foundation of how we run everything. We're highly iterative and we're highly collaborative, and those are two hallmarks of the Scrum process. But in the many years that we've been doing Scrum, we found that there are some weaknesses to Scrum. There are some areas in which Scrum tends to break down a little bit or feel a little uncomfortable, especially to the client partner, because we are a vendor. We're a vendor or a consultancy. Scrum was originally developed by big companies like the Googles and the IBMs and the Apples of the world when they're dealing with an internal project or product. So if you are, say, Google, and you're working on Gmail, you control everything about Gmail. You control who's working on it, for how long, how much money you want to spend on it, when it needs to launch, all of those factors. But when you're a vendor, when you're an outside vendor or a consultancy, there are some aspects of the project that you can't control, such as budget. Mm-hmm. The client partner controls the budget. Mm-hmm. You can control the people working on the project, meaning how many people are going to work on it and for how long, but then the client partner doesn't necessarily have a lot of say about that. So in those circumstances, Scrum itself, the original flavor of Scrum, starts to break down a little bit, and there's a little bit of tension there. Additionally, and this is a newer aspect to consultancy Scrum that we've been developing just in the last couple of months, the design phase of a project doesn't really lend itself well to a Scrum workflow. So when you're working on content strategy, UX, look and feel, wireframing, things like that, that doesn't really lend itself well to a 2-week iteration where you say, today I am going to design the landing page for news. Right. Well, there are all these dependencies that have been built up, right? Like, well, have we created an overall look and feel? Do we have the content ready? What's the user experience going to be like? So you have this inherent built-in dependency tree of, well, we got to have the blueprints in place, and we have to have some kind of planning in place in order to inform all of our design decisions moving forward. Even more more to the point about the design phase and Scrum is that design itself and designers think in terms of the big picture. And even though Scrum focuses a lot on iteration, where you do something and then you'll come back to it later and improve it and improve it and improve it, in a consultancy relationship, you often don't have that luxury because you have a certain budget that you need to hit and a certain launch date that you need to hit. And often there isn't a budget for follow-up work after that project launches. So you need to be able to get everything done within a certain window. So designers, even though they want to come back to the work and refine it, as you go through a design project, you'll start to do new things and introduce new visual patterns or design patterns. And you want to go back and tweak the work that you did a month ago or 3 months ago to catch that work up to what you're doing now. So it's this big picture, how do we go back to the stuff we did earlier and iterate on it? Even though Scrum can totally do that, it's just not a reality when you're a consultancy. It's a theoretical possibility, but it doesn't actually play out in the real world. So designers complain a lot that having to design within a Scrum framework, meaning 2 week chunks of work, and you basically don't go back and iterate on work that you did a month or two or three ago, is kind of like designing while looking through a paper towel tube. So you see like a little dot, and then you move the tube over a few inches and you see another dot, and soon you filled in most of what you needed to do, but it kind of looks like Swiss cheese. So you don't really like take the tube away and open up your eyes and see the big picture and be able to design in a big picture long-term way.
Yeah, it's kind of like the elephant in the blind man.
Exactly, yeah. So, somebody thinks it's a tree, somebody thinks it's a rat, somebody thinks it, whatever. So that can tend to happen on during the design phase. And additionally, often the client or the partner who is paying the consultancy to do this work, they can't really turn design decisions or content decisions around within a single sprint.
Right.
So let's say, we come up with a
That
bunch
was
of
just the
design
rule.
concepts. Yeah, it's going to take weeks or sometimes, a month or two. So rather than saying, hey, we delivered all of this stuff to you at the end of this sprint, do you approve it? Right? That puts them on the spot and they think, well, I got to go run this up the chain. I got to go talk to a whole bunch of different people about, I got to talk to this department and that department and marketing and PR and, all of these people need to weigh in on it. So rather than try to, there were ways in the past where we tried to make that work where we'd say, okay, well, in the first sprint, we're going to deliver all this work. And then in the next sprint, you guys have to go get approval. And then in the third sprint, we'll make any changes as a result of the feedback you got in the second sprint for the work we did in the first sprint. And we called that leapfrogging. And that didn't really work out because guess what? It's confusing. So we've actually shifted to a model now where we only use Scrum in the middle of the project. We do design in sort of a waterfall style where we're looking at the big picture. We're constantly iterating on all of the work that we did a week ago or 3 weeks ago or a month ago. We're constantly engaging with a client in a way that doesn't give them these 2 week deadlines. We still set deadlines, but it's not on a sprint schedule. We do all the design stuff kind of waterfall style. When we start to build, we go into Scrum because Scrum is really made for engineers. It's made for building things, quickly and easily, and delivering value to the client. When the project is essentially done and it launches, Scrum ends at that point. And that point moving forward, we do something different for support and maintenance. So when we enter a support and maintenance phase, when you have a bug on a website and you want it fixed, you don't want to think in terms of, okay, we'll put that in the next sprint, which starts in a week. And then 2 weeks after that sprint starts, we'll be able to actually launch this. Like, no, they want it done right away or, in the next couple of days or so. So at that point, we usually switch to some other kind of project management methodology like Kanban or something like that. But the Scrum is sort of the delicious center of the project.
Of the
And we found
wonderful
that
project sandwich.
it is. So you get all the planning stuff done up front with design and content strategy and all of the super important things. You know what the site's going to do, what's going to be in it, how it's going to act, how people are going to interact with it. And then you start to build. But the slippery slope here is, just a few minutes ago, I said waterfall isn't all that great and you do all this planning up front. And, aren't I just saying that all over again? The goal is to do just enough work. So we create a style guide, we create design patterns, we do just enough work to start to build. And then we start to design in the browser. Or we start to do very scrummy kinds of activities where we can iterate quickly. But we have a plan for how it's generally going to look and feel, but we have not produced a dozen Photoshop comps. We have not put together an exhaustive list of functionality and exactly what modules or technologies will be used to build it. We figure that out as we go while we're building in Scrum.
So you
So
do
we have
like a
enough of a
big
blueprint.
picture. You start the project by sort of coming up with a big picture, and then when you get into details, you switch to Scrum to do detail work. Is that
Exactly.
accurate?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's more, I would actually, instead of using the word detail, I'd say it's the building piece. And this is where we start to draw in lots of other kinds of development philosophies, like designing in the browser or pair programming or all the things that make a project really successful. So when we're doing something like, what was it I just said? Not pair programming. When we're doing something like design in the browser, the value to the client partner there is that they actually get to see the functionality in a browser, exactly how it will look, because that is the thing that will be launched. There's not this cognitive disconnect between, okay, I'm looking at a Photoshop comp and I have to imagine how it's going to look, and I set all these internal expectations about how the typography will render and how things will scale up and down and what will it look like on a device of kind of an intermediate size that isn't quite a tablet and, like a really big phone, for example. What is it going to look like on a really big phone? No designer has the time to do
Code
five or
for
ten.
every single
Yeah.
freaking
So
device.
you do it in the browser the whole time, and you save everybody a lot of time. Plus, the client gets to see what the thing will actually be because what they're playing with is the thing that will launch. So there's not this like, we're not doing HTML prototypes. We're not separating any of that out. We're actually working on the final product.
So you if you're the approach, so this sounds like a wonderful, delicious recipe of yumminess, right? But how does this basically, how does this like sell to a client? Like, or how does a client, do you have difficulty with clients understanding this plan that you've come up with? Especially because a lot of clients are used to sort of your classic waterfall, methodology. And so now you're talking about switching things up a little bit and doing it a different way. Like, do you find that there's a problem explaining what you're trying to do in your methodology to a client? Or, I mean, does it come to that?
I think it depends on the level of experience that the client has with Scrum in the past. So often, if we're bidding on a project or we're talking about our plan for a project, and we say Scrum and they say, "Oh yeah, we know all about it," we don't have to sell at that point, right? They have some experience with it, or maybe they've heard about it and they would like to know a little bit more. It's when an organization is often totally new to making websites, or they haven't made one in a really long time, or they're not familiar with new project management methodologies, that we do need to explain how this process works. Admittedly, it is a little bit complicated to start to explain things like sprints and approval processes and what is the stakeholder, what is the product owner, what is a retrospective. So we often lead with the benefits. So we say we have this methodology that we use. It's a slightly modified version of something that thousands of companies and organizations use. It's very popular. It's called Scrum. Here are a whole bunch of references and things that you can look at if you're curious. So we lead with the benefits. So they know we don't try to explain sprints and stuff like that. We lead with you are going to be able to see all of the work that we do on a regular basis at a minimum every 2 weeks. But the way we develop in the open. You can look at it every day. You can look at it every hour if you want. But a minimum, every 2 weeks, you're going to be seeing work and you're going to approve it or you're going to say that you want changes made to it. So there's full transparency in our workflow and our development process. That's the number one selling point for Scrum.
Have you, so Brian, I'm curious because Brian, you do a lot of discussion in this space as well. Like, what kind of resistance, or do you see resistance to that conversation?
I think that Scrum actually in concept is a very easy sell. People really enjoy the transparency side of it. And, just as a quick aside, I gotta say, Todd, you and I should be talking more often because as you sort of described the progress that you have gone through in terms of working with Scrum and some of the discoveries around design and those sorts of things, I was like, oh my gosh, we've been through the exact same
Yep.
thing. So that's really refreshing. But Addie, to your question, I think really the biggest pushback that I see in a selling situation with Scrum and with all agile processes in general is ambiguity. Enterprises especially, in my experience, really want to have absolute clarity around You know, what is this going to cost? How long is it going to take?
Exactly. And what is
the outcome going to be? And, you know, any real stakeholder who's been in this industry and is worth their salt knows that's an impossible ask for any development company. But, you know, regardless, I think even if the primary stakeholder that you are working with has experience and understands, you know, agile methodologies and Scrum and, you know, iterative work, you're still going to encounter that stakeholder somewhere within an organization that's like, what do you mean you can't tell me exactly how this is, you know, what's going to be included in the final product? And, you know, I think maybe where Todd, you and I differ a little bit with the way Lullabot works is, you know, a lot of times I get kind of choosy around which battles I'm going to fight. And if an organization or a culture within a company is really sort of leaning toward, I need to know, you know, I don't know about this whole iterating thing. I like the transparency, but what's it going to cost at the end of the day? You know, if there's a whole lot of that going on, you know, I tend to sort of go with the grain of, you know, what they're really asking for, which is more of a waterfall type of process.
There's a potential if you end up with a client who says that they like the transparency and this sounds really great, but then they get into the project and they actually really aren't comfortable with it, you know, and they really actually want you to basically do agile waterfall or something like that. Like, that could create its own set of problems down the
road. Yeah. I mean, there's one funny circumstance with the client at one point. It actually, the project ended up turning out beautifully, but they were all on board with the idea of, you know, Scrum and Agile. And then you know, in pretty much every stand up and every interaction we had, they would always say, but this isn't going to cost more than X, right? Guys, remember, we got to get everything done by this amount. And, you know, I think it's some people are wired where they can, you know, really sort of, you know, work with the trust and you know, fluidity that Scrum has. And some people just aren't. And, you know, for me, a lot of the job is trying to qualify and identify who is qualified to participate in a process like that and who really isn't.
Absolutely. And that's that brings up some of the other, I haven't really gone into like some of the changes we've made to Scrum that make it consultancy Scrum, except that, you know, to say we made a lot of changes to it. You actually touch, Brian, on a couple of the things that we have done. The big one is the idea of who is the product owner. So in Scrum, you have this concept of the product owner. The product owner is the person who carries the vision of the project in their head and is responsible ultimately for its failure or success. They are, in Scrum terms, the single wringable neck of the project. Mm-hmm. So if something doesn't go well, the stakeholders will say, who made this decision? Why didn't the project go well? They're going to point at the PO. And the team is looking to the PO to make decisions about what are we going to do this sprint? And what are we going to do next sprint? And what's the priority of these things? And do you accept or reject this work? So that's the role of the PO, is the person who owns the entire product. The
really
first change,
really important role, that
a critical role.
Oh,
how
yeah.
Important
yeah.
It
oh yeah.
It is.
Absolutely. So the first change that we made to it is we don't call that person a product owner, because we're not building a product. We're working on a project. So this is a project owner. So that it's still a PO, so luckily we can use the same acronym, which is nice. So when we're not building a product and we're building a, you know, a transactional website or a content website, it's a project that we're all engaged in. Ideally, the PO is going to come from the client side. That's the best possible scenario. But we have to be real. It involves true empowerment of that individual and a sizable time commitment. So they're going to have to probably attend daily scrums 15 minutes a day. They will absolutely have to attend sizing meetings, meaning where we figure out how difficult certain user stories are, meaning features. They're going to have to go to the demos, and they have to accept and reject work. And it's, you know, it's a sizable commitment. It's between, I don't know, it's anywhere between like 4 and 8 hours a week. And for somebody who, you know, that's a day or a half. And when you're already overworked or you have a lot going on at your job, and now suddenly, oh, you mean I have to spend a day every week also working with this vendor that we've hired? Like, didn't we just hire a vendor to make this problem go away? Isn't that why we hired them, so we
Exactly.
don't have to think about it? So we have to change the conversation there a little bit and say, well, this is really, we're building this for you and this will become yours. So you really need to own it. And at the end of this project, when we're done and we're no longer actively developing it, and instead we shift to more of a maintenance or support or training role, then you know, you will want to feel very confident working with this thing that we've built with you. So if they are not able to, if they're not truly empowered, and if they, meaning to make decisions and to own the consequences of those decisions, like we're going to do this, but we're not going to do that, unless they have the power to do that and unless they have the time, we will assign somebody on our team to become PO. So the backup solution is if the client either says up front, we can't do that, we don't have the time, or we learn a couple of sprints into the project, oh, this person really is not empowered to be making these decisions, we need to have an internal PO. So we have people here who are certified product owners. They will take over the vision of the project and communicate directly with the stakeholders on the client side to figure out what's really important, what can stay, what can go, and that person becomes empowered by the client and internally to make those decisions and to lead the team forward on the project. So that's the first big change that we made to Scrum. Some people, you know, according to Hoyle Scrum, like the original flavor of Scrum, would say that you really should not have somebody who is, quote, in the team being the PO. The PO is supposed to be a separate person. But often when you're a vendor, things get turned inside out because you are an external entity working with an internal group rather than just one big company structure. You know, we're not all within one company. We're two separate companies working on something together. So that's the first big change that we made. The next one, Brian, you'll have to remind me. Oh, budget. Budget. So, working to budget, right?
Brian's good at reminding us about
Yeah, he
budget.
is. Thanks, Brian. So in Scrum you have, well, actually in any project you have the idea of pick two. So there are three aspects of every project. There's budget, timeline, and features. So the money you can spend, when it has to launch, and what you're actually going to build. So in classic Scrum or really any other form of project management, you're supposed to pick two. And then that third thing flexes. So let's say, you know what? It has to launch by January 30th and it must include all of these features. Well, in order for those two things to be firm, the budget has to flex. You can't have all three. It's just not possible for any project. So you have to work with the client or whoever, the PO, to identify what those two firm things are. But in consultancy Scrum, we have to face the reality that even if the client says, yeah, we can go get more money if necessary, they probably won't. So you have to treat budget as one of the two firm things. And instead of it being pick two of three, it's pick one of two. We know that budget is one, even if you're saying it's not. We know that budget is one. Timeline or features, what are we going to flex on? And that helps people understand that relationship of budget. But again, I would say, Brian, the one of the trickiest selling points is the budget aspect. You know, how do we know we're going to be on budget? How do we know we're going to nail all of these features within the budget that we have? One of the things that we do in order to increase transparency around this and make people more comfortable with the idea of how the budgets work is every week or every sprint, we will provide not only a budget used to date, but a forecast of what the entire feature set will cost based on historical burn rates. So every week or every story point, for example, so far in the project is costing an average of X. Well, we know all the story points in the backlog, meaning the list of all the features that need to be built, because we size the backlog. So if we've done 10 story points and 100 remain, we simply take the cost of those 10 story points, multiply it by 10, we know the budget forecast. So it's within about a sprint or two, we know how much this project is going to cost within a very, it's highly accurate.
And you touch on something that's really interesting there, and what's been historically my challenge around selling these types of engagements. I should say also that these types of engagements are definitely our preference, and most of our most successful projects have been, you know, of the Scrum variety. But, you know, I think once you've gotten to a place where you've established trust with a client and can continue in a Scrum fashion, that's one thing. But oftentimes what's really challenging, and where I think there's a lot of kind of natural tension in consultancy Scrum, is, you know, this idea of budget has to be one of the things, and there's always going to be a cost involved with a project. And what really I see a lot of times is, you know, once you're in a project and you have the ability to forecast what the completion rate's going to be and what, you know, how you're pacing toward the budget that exists, those sorts of things, usually that's a nice, happy, harmonious relationship. And everybody's like, okay, great. Yeah. You know, we're on this path and we're going, you know, we're going to get there. We know it's going to cost X, Y, or Z within a certain, you know, margin of error. But what's really tough is, you know, a lot of times those budgets have to exist before a vendor-client relationship is even together. And, you know, what we find kind of difficult is, you know, somebody starts us out on a project, especially when there's not a pre-existing relationship there. And the question is always like, okay, you know, we're going to start on this budget, or we're going to start on this project. What should we budget for the project? And that's a lot more difficult.
Right, when you have no actual data to start to work from at all.
Exactly. Exactly. Like,
well, we can take a wild-ass guess.
Yeah, so it's what's interesting in that case, because estimation, which is like a whole other subject, mm-hmm. But
that's
is
a whole
is
separate podcast to be had.
It is
sure.
Absolutely. It's rough, and what we do in that case is because we don't have a size backlog, because we don't have historical data for that project that we can use to forecast the total cost at the end of the project. We can either use historical data from other projects. Mm-hmm. Similar Comparables. Industries, similar projects, mm-hmm.
yep.
whatever. Or we simply calculate it using team size and duration. Mm-hmm. So we know that a team of three people working 30 hours a week on a project, that's 90 hours a week. We know what our hourly rate is for that project. And we can, the ballparking then is how many people are working on the project and how long is the project going to take in terms of calendar days. If we feel, if our gut reaction is this is a 6-month project, okay, so that's going to be, you know, you're looking at 12 sprints at that point. How much does a sprint cost for a team of three? So that's how we ballpark stuff when we don't have a ready-sized complete backlog.
Yeah, we do something very similar. And in that case, I think if you take it back to the how do you sell, you know, how do you sell this type of relationship? I think at that point it really ultimately comes down to your qualifications, your resume, and your track record in these things. Because at the end of the day, you know, there's really nothing that you're saying, you know, there's nothing that you can demonstrate that says we will complete this project successfully by this time. You know, really all you're saying is we're going to provide a team of people that kick ass for a certain amount of time. And, you know, we know that we'll do what it takes to get this done, and you know that you'll do what it takes to get this done. And a lot of times that's a really hard sell within certain organizations, I've found at least.
So I have another question too that's more instead of client-facing concerns, but like internal to consultancy concerns in terms of how does this affect your resourcing? Like with you estimating, you know, a project, but like if they want to keep iterating and keep iterating, like, you know, when you have to like load in projects down the road and that kind of a thing, like does it create problems with that, or is it really no different than other stuff that you do?
I think it's actually, I think this is the ideal way to handle resourcing, because it changes the conversation such that when we're projecting out our resources for a given quarter or a given year, you know, we actually have a capacity report that has our resources and out per week, and we can project like which project is going to fit in here and there, et cetera, et cetera. And instead of saying like, okay, we know we have this project and we're going to work till it gets done, And then, oh, you know, it's an overage, or we actually need more time. You know, with these types of agreements, most of the time it's very clear. I can say, all right, this team is working on this project for this many sprints, and I know exactly when that ends. And when I'm lining up new business or new projects, I can say, this is when, you know, XYZ project ends, but there's a chance that they're going to want to keep iterating and they're going to extend their team for a little bit, in which case there's some flex there. So it actually, I find it helps me set expectations for potential new clients as well as existing clients much, much more easily. In fact, you know, with existing clients, I basically tell them the team is yours. You can extend this team as long as you need to keep iterating and to keep, you know, working until you reach a point where you're comfortable with it. And most of the time, that really opens things up for really healthy communication, where they can say, yeah, you know, we think we're going to be good after this SOW. You can go ahead and start looking for other projects, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, it's kind of, I actually like it a lot. I'd be curious to hear Todd's thoughts on that.
So sometimes we have the kind of sometimes we're able to provide the kind of flexibility that you talk about, where we say this team is yours until you're done with them. But we're a slightly smaller shop, and we have to staff projects in very deliberate and careful ways. So we actually spend, you know, again, this is a third. So, you know, Addie, you can make it. This is a third podcast we could talk about is staffing projects, resourcing, things like that. We spend 3 hours a week doing staffing. It's a whole, all the directors sit down and work out all the staffing concerns every week for 3 hours. It's a lengthy process, but it allows us to make sure that absolutely the right people are on all the right projects at the right time. So how do we do that, right? How do we know when a project is likely going to end? First of all, like you said, it's ongoing communication. It's account management. One of the things that we do in consultancy Scrum is we have an additional role that we added that is sort of like an account manager or a you know, client relations representative, somebody who is outside of the team, who can talk to the client about their concerns, emotional needs, staffing, stuff that isn't necessarily related to the project or the team as it currently exists. So that way, the client has an outlet to our organization that isn't strictly about the project itself, but instead is about the relationship. So that helps with the resourcing question a little bit. But the biggest thing we do to make sure that we can adequately resource projects is the same thing we do to make sure we can adequately budget projects. Ready, complete, sized backlog. That's the most important thing in consultancy Scrum. And what I mean by that is a backlog is a list of all the stuff you got to do. And when we say ready, sized, complete, we mean ready, all the stories are written, sized, we sized all the stories according to story points, complete, everything in the project is there. Wish list stuff, MVP stuff, you know, maybes, phase two stuff, everything is in there, the whole project. If you don't have that, your project will go over budget, period. You have to have that stuff done before you start building. What Scrum does, what traditional Scrum does, or tends to do at least, is fill the backlog just to the point where they can start a sprint. So, and we did this for years too, because this is just kind of how everybody behaves in Scrum. Hey, let's write enough user stories for what we need to do so that we can fill up the backlog for this sprint. And boy, that was a lot of work, and it takes a long time, and it's really frustrating to do. Let's just get started. Great, let's all just start work. Well, you haven't, your backlog is essentially empty, except for a few miscellaneous things sitting there, and you've pulled all the work that you need to do from the backlog into your sprint, and now you're working on it, but you don't have the long view. So we absolutely insist that before we start building a project, we have to have a full backlog, fully sized. That allows us to budget forecast and to resource the project appropriately on an ongoing basis. So we will know, hey, we complete 10 points per sprint. This is a 100 story point project. It's going to take us 10 sprints. So we know in 20 weeks, this team will likely be done. So that way we can forecast all the people on the project. But again, it's so much of it is about the communication and knowing the client's expectations beyond this project. Do they need to have something like support or maintenance or training or something that is maybe a little bit outside of the Scrum structure that will require one or two people to work on it? And the thing that we found that really ensures that the backlog gets written and is complete is doing discovery in a very deliberate and diligent way. So when we do discovery on a project, it doesn't just include what are your goals, who are your audiences, user personas, things like that. It's we need to write the backlog now. So come up with the functionality, write the backlog, the client sees the backlog, they sign off on it. At that point, there is often some kind of a re-estimation, like a reality check. So, hey, in discovery, we all learned a lot. We learned that there's actually this whole division in your organization that needs to be involved in the project. Or we learned that there's this whole section of the website that it turns out you don't really need because it's not really in line with your goals as an organization. You thought you needed it, but it turns out you don't. At that point, we have a pretty clear picture of what we need to do, and we can adjust the budget downwards or upwards or adjust the team or the deadlines or whatever. But that kind of discovery thing up front allows us to create the backlog, which then allows us to forecast everything. So everything really, you need to be very deliberate about your planning up front.
Yeah, I would echo that. And that's one thing that I think I kind of glossed over in my answer is that absolutely throughout a project, once you're in a project, in terms of knowing when it's going to end, with every project that we're on, we have PMs that very rigorously go through the backlog and have a projection of or an estimate of what's completed and what's left to be done. But even still, going through that process, there are always sort of interesting hidden things that can come up, and kind of throw the best laid plans to waste, as I'm sure you've seen, Todd. Things that you unexpectedly think that you're about to finish a project, and then wow, here's some new scope and new
Or
projects that
stakeholder changes, and they have no
yeah.
idea, huh?
Those sorts
We
of
call
things.
that one the voice in the shadows.
Right.
Exactly. The mysterious stakeholder who emerges right towards the end of a project and suddenly has a lot to say about it.
Yeah, you're like, ah, oh, where were you
And
at the beginning? That's the important part.
that's kind of a different thing altogether. But yeah, that definitely that too. But I think, what I see happening more often than not with our projects is as we're going through that process and as we're projecting things out, suddenly there is a new initiative that's coming from the business, or marketing or something like that, that needs to suddenly be a priority and work into our, next 3 to 6 month plans, which often works out to our benefit because that means, oh, hey, we thought we were going to taper back this team or move off this project. No, instead, actually, we're going to need to ramp up or continue moving forward. But those sorts of things, I guess the point of what I was trying to say is that, yes, that sort of discovery and ongoing estimation and planning is critical to knowing when these things are going to be done and to be able to resource and project things out. But I find at least that there's always sort of things that are jumping in, trying to get those same resources or changing up those priorities as time goes on.
So we should probably wrap things up, but I also wanted to put out there before we sort of fade away, and I think there's plenty more for another podcast, just putting that out there as well. But so Todd, I know that you have spoken on this. Are there other like events or places where people can hear more about like your method or this just generally like dealing with consultancy Scrum and stuff like that, other resources that are out there?
Absolutely. So I will be speaking at Sand Camp at the end of January.
That is
So if
in
you're
San Diego.
in San Diego, so if you're there, you can see me talk about this as well as no RFPs, which is something that Brian and I have collaborated on in the past, and perhaps some other things too. Additionally, when this podcast is released, so right now, everybody, you can go to consultancyscrum.org. This is a website where we're going to collect. We want it to be kind of a. We want a lot of people to be able to contribute to this. So this is all going to be on GitHub, and you can, add resources or language or whatever you want to it. It's simply intended to be a site where people can go learn about consultancy Scrum and maybe download a couple of resources about it, as well as we want to start collecting interesting links or related materials. So we hope that consultancy Scrum will become a place where people can go to find all those resources, to see when people are talking about this stuff. There are other organizations out there that that think about this stuff. There's a group, there's a consulting, I can't remember their name right now, but there's a consulting company out there that consults specifically on how to do this well. I'm not at all familiar with their materials or anything, but certainly, like, we're not the only ones thinking about this stuff, and we would encourage people to check out consultancyscrum.org, or, you know, send us stuff on Twitter or LinkedIn or whatever you like to use, and we want that to become like a library of resources.
Nice. Awesome. Cool. Well, so as we wrap up here, do either of you have any parting thoughts? To send out to the ether, just generally. It doesn't even have to be about consultancy scrum.
I have a quick one that I think Brian will have a lot to add to. To frame this real quick, when you're a vendor, you are often confronted with this dilemma of the scope of work, the SOW, or the statement of work. And it is the legal document that explains what you're going to do. It often includes how long it's going to take and how much money it's going to cost. And of course, all three of those things sound a little bit antithetical to Scrum. Like, how do you, in a legal document, define what you're going to do when you haven't even really totally defined it yet? So how do you make that work? And often it's that's the most challenging part, honestly, is when an organization really needs to have a well-defined statement of work or scope of work, how do you make that fit into this kind of methodology where things are supposed to be iterative and flexible and collaborative. What we like to do in our statements of work, SOWs, is talk about the goals, not the implementations. So focus less on deliverables and more on what the client needs to have done. They need to have a website that does some of these things, but the goals will be these. So we work towards goals, not specific deliverables. In other words, we're thinking about the value of what we're providing and not necessarily the nuts and bolts of what we're providing, because that might change. If this is a year-long project, there might be a new technology that emerges in 6 months that renders half of the stuff that we're doing void or will make things tremendously easier. And then how do we redirect the budget into doing more interesting stuff now that they can save a bunch of money? So that's one way in which we handle it. And Brian, I'd be curious to hear how you handle the SOWs.
Similar, actually. Normally, they're focused on the resources in the team, and then usually the scope of work or statement of work is high level enough that we retain a lot of flexibility in terms of how we achieve the goals that are listed. So, you know, it's really, and a lot of times that's, you know, a large conversation to have with the legal department, but, you know, basically capture the highest level goals that you can, while leaving the details flexible enough so that you have the ability to work in an iterative, flexible manner. And I would say my parting thought, besides saying Happy New Year, is to say that if you are doing this as a consultancy, if you're doing consultancy Scrum as an agency or as a dev shop, be prepared to continue to sell the idea, because I think one of the things that is really a trap that's easy to fall into is to think that once you've kind of explained the concept, that you know, then you're done and everybody's on the same page. But oftentimes, especially with larger organizations, there are different people that, you know, come in and out of projects and interact with them in various weird ways that you may not foresee. And this type of vendor-client relationship is not the norm. And so it's something that you're going to have to continue to sort of sell the value on over and over and over again as you work through a project.
Fair enough. Cool. Well, thanks so much for coming on. Yeah, this was really, I feel like we could probably talk for at least another hour about this.
So I know I could.
we might be scheduling some follow-up podcasts on this, just FYI. But yeah, thanks so much for coming on and taking the time to share with our listeners. And hopefully I'll be seeing you guys soon. Brian, I think I'll be seeing you in a couple of weeks, but...
Yeah, woo!
See where I track you down to. I'm definitely going to see you at DrupalCon Austin, so we know
Excellent.
That's a given. So.
Yep. Well, thank you so much, Addy. This has been really great.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks, Addy. And thanks, Todd. This is, I love hearing your thoughts.
Likewise. It's always great talking shop with you about all the business sides of stuff, because often that doesn't get a lot of exposure in our industry. So these kinds of conversations are really, really valuable for a lot of people in ways that they probably don't realize until they start to think about it really deeply.
Totally.
Thanks a lot. And for our dear listeners, if you have thoughts or comments about this podcast, you can always leave comments on lullabot.com. But you can also get in touch with us through Twitter at twitter.com/drupalizeme. Facebook, same thing, facebook.com/drupalizeme. And we also have our contact form on the site, drupalize.me/contact. And also, if you have ideas for other podcasts that you want to hear about, questions, burning questions that you have, let us know, and we'll pull them out into the light of day. So until next time, happy Drupaling. Talk to you guys later. Thanks. Bye.